Welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 3. Okay, now we're getting into the course fairly much, and yes, that's what I've been doing all weekend. The course, we're going to talk about a couple of the difficulties that people have had with some of the labs and what we plan to do with the remote bundle, and we're also going to talk about what is the contents of Chapter 3 and what things you do and don't need to know and all that sort of good stuff. Okay, first question. I'm going to have to play with this later today. Has anybody yet played with Wireshark? If so, could anybody get anything to work on it?
I have done some work with the command line. In fact, I have somebody made a batch file on the program I list, which prompts you for a number of parameters, so you can use Wireshark from the command line. But we can work on that and figure out what can and can't be done.
Stand by.
Okay, let them know. Is that working now, Grace, or not?
Yep. Yeah, I can hear. Yep, you're fine.
Okay, don't ever switch the mute switch on your $9 set of Skype headphones ever again. Okay. Right. Yeah, we'll have a look at that. Did you send that batch file through to Cavi Instructors yet, Pranav, or is that on your list of things to get to at some point? I remember you mentioning the batch file to us in the past, but I can't remember whether you actually sent it through yet or what happened with that.
No, it's on my to-do list. It's also on my blog, so I'll pull it from there and send it across.
Okie dokie. Well, you can either send us the link to the blog on Cavi Instructors, or you can send it across and we'll dig it out that way. Obviously, we'll stick it up somewhere on qcat.org, probably under the extras subfolder, and people can get at it. One of the big problems we've had with packet tracing from a vision impaired perspective is basically seeing the forest for the trees. What you've basically got to do is get Wireshark or whatever to be as specific as possible about the packets it's dumping, and then limit the amount of output so that you can actually see what's going on without being overwhelmed by information scrolling onto your machine. Because obviously if you were tracing every packet on a network, you could be looking at 300 or 400 packets per second going over the Ethernet. That's obviously too many packets to be looking at one by one. So what we need to do is look at ways of figuring out which packets we'd like to watch. Is anybody here on the blind sysadmins list? Okay, I'll take that as a no. All right, I'll try and sign up and see what they're using for packet tracing. Christopher Toth found one that you could actually select things with list boxes and say exactly which packets you wanted to see, and then it would come up in this read-only scroll edit thing. But he can't remember the name of it, which is a bit unfortunate because that would have been really nice to use. Apparently you could do set a whole lot of sub-parameters and then just see the packets that actually came through in the dump. Okie dokies. Now, So Wireshark, we have to have a play with and see what will and won't fly. We should be able to get some output out of it. A lot of these labs seem to rely on you from watching the packets travel backwards and forwards between the different programs. I think what we're going to do is we're going to do the minimum amount of that we can, so that it still remains educational, because it's often very difficult with speech to get an overview of what is happening when you've got such a high data of packets and things. So we're going to have to find a way of letting you see the traffic you need to see without sort of overloading the display. Because I think if you're using Wireshark as a sighted person, there's all sorts of buttons and things you can click to make it do cool things. And whilst a lot of that functionality will be accessible to us from the command line, we need to find out how that's going to function. So when it says watch packets, don't worry too much about that until further notice. We are working on a way of you doing it and seeing some of the packets go backwards and forwards. I've been working in networks for 15 years now, and I haven't actually done that much packet tracing in that time because the volume of information does make it difficult. It's sort of a last ditch sort of setup that you do when you've tried exhausting everything else. Okay, now, did anybody manage to get anywhere with the wiki tutorial on twiki.org? How accessible was it? Because I hadn't looked. I thought it would have been a little bit tricky but doable. Okie dokie, cool. We are actually getting a couple of students to help us out with the fine-tuning of the bundle. Now, we have a technical problem with the bundle, which is not a problem we can easily work around. A lot of people will have seen in the lab that there are references to eagle-server.example.com. Has everybody seen that sort of nomenclature in the labs?
I don't know about the labs, but I saw it. I saw some messages on the Cavi list.
Oh, well, interestingly enough, there is actually a domain called example.com, and it does sort of show up with some stuff. But basically, the Eagle server is meant to simulate the internet cloud. So on the Eagle server, you have an IRC server, you have a wiki server, there's an email server, there's a few other services that run. So what we're going to do is we're going to try and get the bundle working to the point where you can actually log into the Eagle server and play with these wikis and things. The other thing that we're also going to do once we get the machine stable is we are going to bring up a wiki on qcat.org. So we're looking for suggestions as to what sort of wiki people would like, or what one people are familiar with. My ex-wife is happy to put on DocuWiki, which is one where you mark up text files, but I'm wondering whether people want MediaWiki or TWiki or which wiki we want. So we've got to figure out which one we'd like and make it happen, because I'm thinking we can distill a lot of the information out of the mailing list archives into the wiki, and that will make students as getting up and running stuff a lot more friendly, and we can then have students working on various bits and pieces to get things like the getting started documents and stuff like that. Okie dokies. Now, there was a question in the lab about how to do bandwidth calculations, because they were asking about how long it was going to take to send a certain sound file and stuff like that. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go over basically very quickly the definitions of bandwidth, and I'm going to go over the way in which you calculate times and things for bandwidth and stuff like that. Now let's take a typical example of these sorts of units. Now, there are two types of bandwidth. One of the types of bandwidth is analog bandwidth. An analog bandwidth refers to the carrying capacity of a circuit in the analog domain, and analog bandwidth is usually measured in kilohertz or megahertz, because you're actually looking at how much analog information or how much waveform information you can carry across a medium, whether that be optical fiber, wireless, or copper cabling. Now, if you look at digital bandwidth, however, can anybody tell me what is the unit of measure for digital bandwidth?
Bytes per second?
No.
Bits per second.
That is correct. Bits per second. Why isn't it bytes per second? Because sometimes when you work on certain communications lines such as serial ports and stuff, if you are sending data over a serial cable, yes, people still do, if you've got some of those legacy horrific blindness note takers, they still tend to love the serial ports. You end up with a case where there is actually one start bit, 8 data bits, and 1 stop bit, which actually means that 1 byte of data actually takes 10 bits to transmit, which is why we actually measure bandwidth in bits per second, because it's not affected by the overhead of the transmission medium if we measure it in raw bits per second. Okie dokie. Now, the other thing to keep in mind with data communications is when we say kilobits per second, we actually mean thousands of bits per second, as in 1,000. When we say megabit, we mean 1,000,000. When we say gigabit, we mean 1,000,000,000. We do not mean kibi, mibi, and gibi, which are hard to say. So, a gigabyte is actually 1,000,000,000 bytes, but a gibi, G-I-B-I, byte is actually the 2 to the power of 31 or whatever it is to get you to a billion, the 1,073,000,000, whatever it is. So that's something that's worth... Sorry, does someone want to say something? All right. So say, for example, and we're measuring bandwidth in bits per second, digital bandwidth in bits per second. Let's take some simple examples of other bandwidth units and work those through, and then we'll come back to actual, like, data and stuff. Okay. It depends on which version of kilobyte you're talking about. There are actually two versions of kilobyte. One is worth 1,000 and one is worth 1,024, one being 2 to the power of 10 and one being 1,000. And I believe that the ISO standard measuring units for the 1,024 is actually KIBIBYTE. And I believe a kibibyte is the actual correct name for a 2 to the power of 10 kilobyte. If somebody would like to wiki that up after lecture and prove me wrong, I will not take it personally in the slightest.
Okay.
I'm always happy to be corrected, and there have been lectures where I have completely said the wrong thing, and somebody's gone and looked it up, and it turns out I've been completely wrong, and it's the other way around, and I don't take that personally at all. I just get a little bit wiser, or at least that's what I like to think. But yeah, look, when people say kilobyte, there is an ambiguity as to how many bytes in a kilobyte. Now, does anybody remember how if you've got a 320 gigabyte hard drive, it's got, you know, 320,073,000,000 rah-rah-rah bytes, but when you actually look at the size of it in Windows, it shows up as 307,852 megabytes or something like that. Anybody seen those discrepancies? Part of it is the overhead of the file system. When you're looking at the, you know, the root directory and the master file table and stuff, but most of it is because
the file system or something taking up space.
Well, that's some of it, but most of it is because Windows defines a megabyte as 1,048,576 bytes, which is 10^20, I think. If you actually look at the drive definition of megabyte, which is written at the bottom of Western Digital's pages and Seagate's pages and Fujitsu's pages and IBM's pages, it says one megabyte is 1 million bytes, 1 gigabyte is 1 billion bytes.
Historically there was a problem with Windows like 98, and if you did a size of a file in Windows 98 and then you did that same size file with the DOS window, they'd be different sizes, and you couldn't accurately determine how much disk usage you had. With some of the windows, you had to go into the command line and go get it in order to really know how much stuff you had on your drive.
I'm not familiar with that idiosyncrasy, although if anybody's ever had to go back to Windows 98 recently, and I hope none of you ever have had to, occasionally we see some boxes with it still installed over here because we've got some people running some very old computing equipment. You just can't believe the crud you used to put up with Windows 98, and Windows 95 is even worse. 98 second edition was better than 95, but it really was a case where things were pretty bad. I can't actually vouch for the space, the free space thing. What I can tell you is that obviously, if you're going to do that, Grace, go over with Alex. Okay, because you can if you want to go over and sit with Alex and do it. Okay, well, my condolences. Now, yeah, it'll be a good revision for you. We've got one local student in. Yeah, so essentially, disk space on most modern machines is always rounded to an integral number of clusters, and usually clusters are 1024 bytes or 2048 bytes or 4096 bytes or whatever, and in DOS you actually have a file size that's measured in bytes, whereas in CPM you only actually had a file size that was actually measured in clusters. So under CPM, for example, you would round everything to 128 bytes and pad the file with garbage, which was why end of file marks was so important. But I digress. Okay, so gigabytes, as far as the drive manufacturers are concerned, are billions of bytes. And megabytes are millions of bytes. According to the RAM industry, however, a megabyte is 10^10, and a gigabyte is 10^20, and a terabyte is 10^30.
So which one of them's right?
They both are. It just depends on which context you're using them in. In data communications, when we talk mega, giga, kilo, we are talking a million, thousand, billion, just to get them in the same order that I gave them. Whereas if we're talking RAM, we are actually talking binary ones. And I believe, as I said, that the KIBI measure actually calls that binary, and that actually shows that it's actually a binary representation, so it's the 2 to the power of 10 version of kilobyte. So they're both correct. Ah, thank you. Everybody looking in, has everybody got their chat window open? There's a link to all of these on Wikipedia that Alex has just dug up for me in the background. So if you don't have your chat window open, you may have missed that. Yeah. Everybody is familiar how to, well, most of you are familiar with how to do jaws and tables. Once you get into the table, use Control, Alt, and your arrow keys to navigate the table. And if you're actually looking for a table in a web page, press T to jump to the table. So that's your 101 table navigation stuff. And for anything more complex than that, feel free to crack open the jaws help, which I have always found rather enlightening. And surprisingly underutilized by the majority of JAWS users, including me. Okie dokie. Alright, so let's assume we're talking bandwidth for the moment, and we're talking in thousands and millions and billions, and they're the ones that we're going to deal with, okay? Now, let's take a regular, and we'll do this in the American units, because I don't know, but you guys hate the British so much, yet you're still in Imperial, so here we go. Well, you probably don't hate the British anymore these days, but, you know, back a couple of hundred years, they didn't like the British too much. Let's assume that we're going to measure speed in miles per hour. And we're driving a car, which is a scary thought indeed, but it just so happens we've got a big flat thing that we're not going to run into anything on. And we are driving our car, and we are driving it at 60 miles per hour. Okay? Question one. How many miles does the car travel in 1 hour? Type your answer into chat.
60.
Okay, obviously I was a bit lagged there. Anybody else, you would have typed your answer into chat. All right, how far does the car go in half an hour? It goes 30 miles. Right, how did we work that out? We said that if it was a car traveling at 60 miles an hour and we had half an hour, 60 multiplied by a half is 30, which is how we work that out, because the equation is actually you can actually shuffle the equation around to work out whichever one is missing. Yeah, distance equals speed by time, and then you can actually shuffle that around to actually make it whatever you want by, you know, shifting whichever one you want to whichever side of the equation. Okay? Alright, so conversely, if the car travels for 2 hours, how many miles has it gone? Okay, and you're all going, he's a dill. Why is he giving all these stupid questions like this? I mean, you know, has he got any more dumb examples for us? Right, okay. Now we're going to do bandwidth, and it's going to get a little bit harder. I don't know why it's going to get a little bit harder, but this is purely what's going to happen. All right. Now, bandwidth works the same way, and we'll try and get some numbers that aren't going to be difficult to work with. I encourage people for this particular exercise Crack open your copy of Windows Calculator. I don't expect everybody to be working this out in their head for the bandwidth, because it's a little bit more complex. All right. If we have a line that can transfer 100,000 bits per second, which ironically enough is 100 kilobits, if it transfers 100,000 bits per second, how much data is transferred in 6 seconds? Bits. You are absolutely correct. All right. Now, because bandwidth is measured in bits per second, before we can do any calculations with bandwidth, we need to convert our file size into bits. And we do that by multiplying the file size in bytes by 8 to give us the number of bits. Okay, so say for example we have a file that is 1K long. Actually, let's make this something reasonable, actually. Alright, let's assume we are on a dial-up modem that runs at 2,400 bits per second. Oh, yeah, were those the days. Anybody remember 2,400 bits per second modems, or am I too old?
No idea.
Yeah, they were really cool.
Well, my first modem went at 300 bits per second, and it was one of those ones with the telephone on the top where you dial up the bulletin board, and then when you hear the guard tone, you'd flip the little switch down to flick it into modem mode. Wasn't quite as ancient as the acoustic couplers, but... Okie dokie. Now, so say for example, we have a 2,400 baud modem, just because that's what we're going to work on. Okay, and we have a file that is 400K big, alright? 400 kilobytes, which is the regular kilobytes, okay? So what we have to do is we have to multiply 400 times 1024... and we get 409,600 bytes, okay?
No idea.
Well, you're supposed to have Windows Calculator open here and be bashing things into it. That's the plan, okay? Windows R Calc. Well, you don't have to. I don't really care if you don't. But this is the sort of stuff that you need to be able to work these calculations if you're on the job or something, or somebody's going to ask you how long it's going to take to send the 5-meg email with the picture of the 6 kittens and the family that they sent over to their grandmother. And they're the sorts of questions that you're supposed to answer. Okay. So, 400 times 1,024 is 409,600. I'm happy with that result, because I worked it out. Right, we want that in bits, so we times it by 8 again. And we get 3,276,800 bits. Okay? Can anybody tell me how would I find out how long it would take to transfer that many bits over a 2,400 BPS modem? What would I do with that big number?
Divide it by 2,400.
Divide it by 2,400, which is the number of bits per second. Okay, 1,365 and a third. We'll just go 1,365 seconds. Okay, 1,365 seconds divided by 60, 22.75, 22 and a quarter minutes to download 400K. Wow. Any questions on that working procedure? Anybody at all confused by that?
You seem to be mixing definitions of bits and of the kilobit thing, or Because when is the bandwidth definition, when is the disk definition that you took?
Ah, but you see, this is where it gets complicated, you see. Because when Windows shows you a file in kilobytes, it's showing it to you in the binary it's showing you into the 2 to the power of kilobytes. So yes, you're absolutely correct. I am mixing definitions because when you look at a file size in Windows, it is going to be shown up in the binary kilobytes. The only way you can get around that is to actually multiply the number of bytes rather than the number of kilobytes. So I'm just trying to flag that Windows will show you it as the 2 to the power of 10 version of kilobytes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, look, and I'm glad you picked up on it, but yeah, I was actually deliberately doing that to see who would pick up on it and go, hang on, he said they were this, and now he's saying that they're that. Well, I'm saying that they're that because that's how Windows shows them to you. Okay? All right. Now, let's work another example, all right? This will be a more realistic example. For some bizarre reason, and I usually pick on a student, Josh wants to download a copy of Attack of the Cybernetic CCNA Student Gone Wrong, okay? And it's a DVD movie, and it's 4,400 megabytes.
So under the file properties of a...
Yeah, under the file properties, go ahead. Under the file properties, what were you going to say, Josh?
Under the file properties, it says, it says about the, it says the size in kilobytes, and then beside it says the size of bytes. So only look at the size in bytes, then?
Yeah, look at the size in bytes and multiply that by 8 to get the number of bits that the file would take up.
Gotcha.
All right. Now, say, for example, Josh is wanting to download Attack of the Enraged Cybernetics Enhanced CCNA Student, and it's 4,400 megabytes because, for some reason, he wants to download the DVD rip. I have no idea why this is, okay, but it'll do for our example. So what we do is we take 4,400... and we multiply it by what a megabyte is, which is 1048576, because it's 4,400 megabytes. I've just made the size up, okay? A DVD actually stores 4.7 gigabytes, or 4,700,000,000 bytes in the drive manufacturer's definition, okay? So that's the drive manufacturer's, which is million billion. And it actually stores 4,489 binary megabytes, or Microsoft megabytes, which I can call them, okay? All right, so say, for example, we multiply our 4,400 by 1,048,576, and we hit enter. We get 4,600,000,000, and show me the rest of the line, Braille display, 4,613,734,400. That's the number of bytes in that, okay? So we multiply that by 8 to get the number of bits, and we get 36,900,000,000 and a really big number, okay? How fast would you like your DSL line to run at? Anybody got a suggested speed of a DSL line that we'd like to feed in here?
7 megs per second, which is actually what my speed is.
7 megabits or 7 megabytes per second?
7 megabytes.
You sure?
Well, Well, Quest told
one
me 7
fast
megabits.
DSL lines.
Okay, what is the highest download speed you've ever seen on that line?
Highest download speed would have to be 500-600 kilobytes.
Then that is not a 7 megabyte line, that is a 7 megabit line. Okay? This is what we're trying to demystify. You've got to get your units correct, otherwise it makes no sense. And that goes for everyone, I'm not just picking on you. Okay, so let's say you're doing a 7 megabit line, and we'll divide that by 7000000. It's going to take him 5,200 seconds to download that movie. That's assuming that that he's getting full download speed all the time. And if we divide that by 60, it'll take him about 88 minutes to download that video.
That ain't that bad.
Yeah, but that's assuming that you are going to get that speed, and that is assuming that you can actually allocate all of your line speed to that particular task, and not that any of us would ever do this, but it also depends on the health of the swarm if one happens to be torrenting this sort of stuff, which of course none of us would, okay? But would ever. Right? Well, none of us never do that, okay? But I figure that if Cisco is going to talk about Nutella in some of the labs, I can talk about BitTorrent. Yes, there are packet headers, and there is an overhead of 5 to 10% for TCP/IP. And that can be factored in if you really can be bothered. But usually we don't bother because it's a near enough estimation. You're probably only going to be thrown out by 30 seconds to a minute over a long transfer. But if you actually want to add in all of the packet headers, you can do that. It can get a little bit more complex because a lot of DSL lines use PPP over Ethernet. And that has a certain encapsulation overhead, so you've got the encapsulation overhead of the PPP over Ethernet plus the actual overhead of the TCP packets, which is about 40 bytes per packet. So that is something that's worth mentioning, but we are working on approximate stuff here to give you some idea. I don't know whether anybody's seen the episode of Star Trek where Commander Data was giving all of the times in seconds and point whatever of a second and stuff. I mean, we don't... It depends how accurate you really want to be.
One of the lab questions on the third lab is to factor that in at 5%. So would you just divide that by 0.5?
No. You would add 5% to the actual size of the file. So if you had a calculator with a percent button, you would say plus 5 and hit the percent key, or you would multiply the size by 0.05 and then add the result of that onto the add that onto the result of the actual original file size.
Or you can multiply it by 1.05.
You can multiply by 1.05. That would also work. Which would give you 105% of the file size, which would be the file size plus 5%.
So you might have covered this earlier. I've been bopping in and out, as you've all probably noticed, due to my not talking. But in regards to...
We had noticed that.
I'm sure. In regards to differing definitions of bits and bytes between hard drive manufacturers and the operating system, well, basically hard drive manufacturers and everybody else, you'll notice when you're looking at a file and properties that it'll give actually two different file sizes. Like, it'll give the size and then the hard disk space that it takes up. So is the second value what it is according to the hard drive manufacturers, and the first one is what it is according to Windows?
No, the first one is, let me pull this up and have a look. so that I know what I'm looking at and I'm not just making it up. Because I like making stuff up, but it doesn't help when you're lecturing because the students tend to be a bit cranky. Hang on. Find me a file. Here we are. Here, the headache release binaural beat. That'll do it. Of course, everybody knew that the shortcut for properties in, what's its name, in Explorer and stuff was Alt-Enter. Very handy, that.
Didn't know that, actually.
Well, there you go. Alt-Enter will pull up the properties.
So you are learning things in this class.
Shh, don't tell him that. Well, they'll start expecting I'll be teaching you guys things. I can't have that. No, one of those figures is how big the actual file is, as in the number of bytes in size that file is, and then the other figure is what is actually allocated on the disk when you round it up to the number of clusters that's actually been allocated to that file. Because remember, NTFS and the FAT file system allocate space in clusters.
Right, right. That's too bad, because I was hoping there was some convenient way of just looking at it in Windows and seeing, like, how much it... Yeah. Oh, well.
Yes, well, there you go. Well, probably worth demystifying that anyway. Alrighty. What... Okay, any questions on any of that bandwidth stuff? Has that sort of demystified a lot of the bandwidth stuff? Yay, okay. Alright. Nobody talked... you're wandering somewhere, are you, Grace? You're wandering somewhere, are you? Right, nobody talked to Grace, she's wandering somewhere. I'll tell you when she gets back. Because we actually have a habit of dropping our headphones without telling people, which is very rude of us, and then somebody goes to talk to us and we're not there. And we really shouldn't do that because sighted people do it to us all the time and it's really frustrating, but hey. Now, that is bandwidth calculations and sound files and stuff. Has anybody... does anybody know whether sound recorder still has the limit of only being able to record for 60 seconds or something?
I believe that's been removed in Windows 7, and they no longer record in WAV. They record in a WMA file format.
Bletch.
Yeah, I think they do that.
And that is the only option, too.
Yeah. You can't even change it.
I hate .org just as much as I... Ugh. Nothing uses .org. No. No.
Depends what you're
anyway.
Using.
It does depend on what you're using, but unfortunately all of the equalization and stuff across the org spectrum is all bizarre and lame. Anyway, we can have a mud fight about that next time I'm in Victoria, but the other problem with org is that most of us...
I use Miro Encoder.
A lot of people don't even have devices that can play org. Has anybody ever seen an iPod not running Rockbox play an org file? Nah. What about that other MP3 player? Nah. So, I used to love OG 2 until I realised that about 6 of the 300 play OG. No, I don't think they do.
They should. They're usually really good about stuff. They can play FLAC. They should do OG. That's really dumb.
What's Cohen? I thought Cohen was the name of the barbarian in Terry Pratchett's books. They had Cohen the Barbarian.
It's the name of a Hollywood franchise.
Okay. The squeeze blocks. I think the squeeze box plays OG, and the squeeze block box definitely plays FLAC, and MPD plays OG. Anyway, if you happen to like OG, good for you. I know Patrick Perdue likes Ogg.
On the software side, it's pretty easy because you can get direct show filters that'll play Ogg and everything, and its own licks, and you can do it in Winamp and Foobar and everywhere.
Yes, you can also do that with. Yeah, on the hardware side, there is a fair bit of floating point in the Ogg decode, I think. Or there was a fair bit of floating point in the Ogg decode routines, which is why it was difficult to implement in hardware, because floating point is not the easiest thing to implement. I think what ended up happening was that they ended up moving towards... They did do a fixed point implementation of the Ogg decoder, which made it easier to implement in hardware. But it was fairly CPU intensive. But that's okay, you're speaking to two people here who just keep their audio content in FLAC, so that just bypasses any of the lossy compression arguments. So that's all good.
Yeah, I just use audiobooks. Audiobooks I can fit, double.
I'm actually converting a load of stuff to MP3 as we
stuff. Encoding time's much faster with Ogden as well.
Depends on your encoder, actually.
I get and about it depends on your hardware. 3 to 4 times faster on my computer, at least for lame, MP3 lame, and to me it's a big difference. If you have to use an encoder that's got SEE enabled, if it does, then it's really, really fast.
It depends on your encoder and depends on the front.
There is actually a version of lame that uses. Slow. Yeah, there is actually a version of lame that uses SSE as well, and it's fairly. It's fairly snappy. Yeah. I mean, what can I say? I used to encode the lectures with LAME on the X server, and it encodes at about 89x real time. So it was nice and fast. Do a 2-hour lecture in about
400 times. I want to get about 400 times, 500 times.
Yeah. What quality of OGG though are you encoding?
That's for the minimum. It's like the 24 kilobyte. Here we go. 24.
Quality zero.
But I put it on my Daisy player, and it runs really easily, and you can fit 100 hours on a CD.
AAC can sound a little bit.
Except
for iPods.
Foobar will play. Ask Drew.
Nokia phones tend to play good Ogg, actually.
Okay, guys, can we get back to the lecture, though? I've actually got some stuff I've got to get through here today. Yeah, this stuff can come on Friday for social. But, and look, the other thing I will say is that the Plex Talk players and stuff have really upped the ante by actually allowing Ogg, FLAC, and MP3. And if you like that sort of stuff, you like that sort of stuff. We put our lectures up in MP3 because it is the lowest common denominator. AAC is the Advanced Something Codec. I can't remember what the... Advanced Audio Codec. There we go.
Advanced Audio, yeah.
It's one of those Apple things that Apple tends to use a lot of.
Yeah, that one,
it's supposed to replace MP3, but nobody told LAME or the rest of the world, so
it is the best by far.
I think the reality is that when it came down to it, they actually had it was what was actually manufactured in the chips, and Philips came out with thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of very cheap chips that are able to decode MP3 very efficiently. So that's what we ended up with. It's also possible. It's also possible to get your Nokia phone to play FLAC files, but nobody usually bothers.
Yeah, not even I'd bother with that.
Okay,
yes,
back to the
Drew
next
Drew Mocha going on record as not wanting FLAC in some case.
Ooh.
We can move on now. I just had to make... Yeah, it's recorded for prosperity, and yeah, we can move on now.
Okay, we can. Good. This is something that's worth noting. Okay. So now that we know that sound recorder is brain damaged in Windows 7, in fact, it's even more brain damaged than it was in the previous version of Windows. Jolly good for it.
I've never used it.
Yeah, apparently it only records in WMA. That's how this conversation got started. Windows 7's one will only do WMA. Yeah, you missed that bit.
Oh, that's so dumb. Will that at least do WMA lossless?
No, I don't think so.
That's stupid. Well, I remember in XP you couldn't get it to go over a minute either. I don't know if that was just me being dumb, because I never tried to play with it
for We've been here about 20 minutes ago. Okay?
Yeah.
Sorry. So, yeah. It's all right. You can go back and listen to the recording, and you'll hear about that.
Sure.
All right. Yeah, I'm sure you won't, but that's okay. All right? Now, maybe you will, if you're having a particularly difficult night sleeping or something, and we're not around to amuse you. The stuff we're actually going to cover in today's lecture, which we're finally going to get to now, is Chapter 3. Does anybody have any questions about Module 2? Pardon me, 2 or anything before we continue on to draw onto Module 3, apart from how do I use Wireshark, which we're working on, and all that sort of stuff. Has anybody got any questions on any of the Chapter 1 and 2 stuff yet? I will take that big fat silence as a no. Don't forget, you can Skype us during work hours. If you don't have my work Skype, it is that one. My home Skype is a different one, and if you happen to find an ad, that one up and ring me on a Saturday night once I've had a few glasses of brandy and creaming soda, I'm probably not going to be very professional when I talk to you. So be warned. And I usually don't add that many people to my home Skype. And brandy and creaming soda is surprisingly nice. Okay. Chapter 3, we're going to cover stuff that involves the application layer of the OSI reference model. And we're going to talk briefly about that. We will all remember that the application layer is what level of the OSI reference model?
7.
It's layer 7.
It is layer 7. It's the one that's away for sausage pizza and all that sort of stuff.
Remember?
Okay, remember? You did. Well done. Please do not throw sausage pizza away.
Life saved.
I like the one about Australia Post, but we won't go into that one. Apparently there's a whole stack of pages of mnemonics that help you remember the OSI reference model, and some of them are not very PC. Okay, so Chapter 3 deals with the OSI reference model applications layer. Is anybody else a bit disturbed by all of these computers with speech bubbles over them that seem to appear in these curriculums? I'll tell you what, if my computers talk that much, there'd be trouble. But they are an educational tool, and apparently this computer says one thing, and then this computer says something else, and they've all got these speech bubbles floating above them, which is a bit odd. But they've obviously pulled that forward from the Discovery curriculum.
I'd like to communicate an actual speech bubble.
Yeah, apparently there's these little speech bubbles, and the speech bubble says, "I have a packet for you," and the other computer says, "I have a packet for you too." It's just like, okay. All right. The application layer is where the applications interact with the OSI reference model. The applications talk to the application layer. This is important, because the applications do not exist in the application layer, they actually talk to the application layer. It was also said that there is actually an eighth layer of the OSI reference model, which is called the Bogon layer, and that consists of the loose nut sitting between the keyboard and the chair, or the user. And it says that no amount of good protocol design can completely eliminate the Bogon layer from the OSI reference model. That's not officially in your test, so you don't need to remember that, but that's the unofficial layer 8. The application layer of the OSI reference model only deals with how the applications talk to the OSI reference model itself. The TCP/IP layer, the TCP/IP application layer, because there is an application layer in the TCP/IP model, contains the application layer, the presentation layer, contains the top three. Session, presentation, and application. Yep. So, the TCP model, it actually folds the functions of those three layers into the TCP/IP application layer. So that's worth mentioning. Now, Chapter 3 is fairly wishy-washy, but basically it goes on about a couple of network services that we all use quite a lot. One of them is Domain Name System, or DNS. Now, DNS is responsible for converting host names into IP addresses, or IP addresses into host names, or various other records you can get from DNS. Hang on, I will be back in a second. I just have to... Okie dokie, for all the good that did. Right, I'm back. Oops, sorry, there we go. I should be much louder now. DNS maps IP addresses to names, names to IP addresses, all that sort of stuff. Has anybody here ever played with NS Lookup at all? Okay, it's actually quite powerful. So, for example, if I open up a command prompt and I type in nslookup, it says default server allison.qcat.org 192.168.100.4. Okay, that's the Spark that's sitting over in the corner here. I want to look up www.qcat.org. Okay, server allison.qcat.org, www.qcat.org. 192.168.100.6. Okay, that's because it's going to map to the machine that's actually sitting inside our network here. Obviously, if you guys looked up qcat.org externally, you would get a different result. So if I went www.qcat.org 203.12.160.36. Okay, 203.206.197.99 is actually an address of my house, because that's my static IP that I've been assigned, because when the server fell over, we snuck in and redirected qcat.org back to my place, because my servers are up and have UPS on them, and the server here wasn't. Now that we've got uninterruptible power supply back here, we will redirect qcat.org back here, and it will go faster. So we apologize for you speed demons who want to see 200k a second, because they all think that the whole of the internet runs at, you know, hundreds of k's per second. You would have been sadly limited to 50 or 60k a second for the last 12 hours or so, because QCAT was running on a slower link. Alright, there are all sorts of things you can do with NS Lookup. You can actually look up, say for example, you can look up name server records. So if I set query type equals NS, and I go qcat.org, it tells me... Okay, it says the name server is www.qcat.org and allison.qcat.org, because I'm inside this network. It would have given me two addresses on Zone Edit's network, which is where QCAT is currently hosted. So, very powerful tool very accessible, which is a little bit unusual, and quite handy for looking up various bits and pieces. And if you guys are really unlucky, I will probably end up writing you an NS lookup lab for you to mess around with a few things. The other thing, has everybody noticed that you cannot ping or trace route to www.cisco.com because cisco.com blocks ping and trace route?
I found that out the hard way.
Okie dokie. Well, I think you can trace route to qcat.org. Yes, you can trace route to qcat.org. That works. Or at least it does when the A record's pointed here. And there's various other websites you can trace route to, such as ciscovision.org. That should work. Let's have a look. Trace RT W period Cisco Vision. Oh, I can't type. And we're tracing route to cavi.ciscovision.org. What a pain. Alright, I have to look into that. Alrighty, now, so that's DNS we've talked about. Now, one of the things they mention in DNS is the DNS is a hierarchical system. You have the root name servers, which process about 200,000 queries per second, and the root name servers are the ones that actually give you the results back for the dot domain that is implicitly on the end of all domains, so www.qcat.org. is the root domain, okay? The root domains are responsible for looking up the top-level domains. So we're talking .com, which is commercial, .org for organization, .edu for educational, .xxx for pornographic, which has just recently been ratified. Then you have a whole stack of country code domains, which is AU for Australia, US for US, TV for Tuvalu, CX for the Christmas Islands. I think there's a .ie for Ireland. What's India? Anybody, do you know, Pranav, at all?
It's IN.
Oh, okay, it is IN. All right. Some of them are a bit unusual, like Germany is DE and Denmark is DK. So they're not always straightforward. Yep, IN for India. Okay, cool. UK for the UK, obviously. Funny that. They are the ISO codes, two-letter country abbreviations. So what happens is when you actually look up, say, for example, www.qcat.org, your DNS client is usually configured to send its queries to a local name server. Okay, local name servers such as the ones that your ISP hands out. However, there are other options. Has anybody here ever played with OpenDNS?
I've thought about it.
Alright, well, OpenDNS is kind of cool. And it can protect you from phishing attacks, and it can run fairly...
Yes, that's what I use.
However, there is a gotcha with OpenDNS. One of the problems with OpenDNS is that when you actually do a name server query on anything, you end up with a case of it actually returning a name server record pointing at itself for every query you do. So if you do a lookup for www.garbagetrashcan.com, it will always return a name server record to point to one of its servers, so that you will then go and look that server up, and then it'll redirect you to that silly OpenDNS. You ended up here. Perhaps you meant to be somewhere else. So be aware of that. That quirk with OpenDNS is that it will return extra NS records that don't turn up in a standard DNS lookup. Not that it matters, but it does mean that you'll always get one NS record back rather than a failure response if you put in something that's complete garbage. I use OpenDNS at home as well. There are ads on those pages, that's true. But it's also true that there are actually plans you can buy, like $5 or $10 a year or whatever, for like home protection and stuff, and you can block from phishing, pornography, a few other things. And if you buy the home plan, it actually works fairly well. So just depends on whether that's something you want to do. I don't know. I haven't played with Google's public DNS. As far as I've been told, it can be a bit flaky, and it's certainly slower than OpenDNS. The other thing to be aware of with Google is they do some interesting things. One of the problems with Gmail, or one of the features I should say, is that if you subscribe to a mailman list through Gmail, you'll never see the posts that you make to the list turn up in your Gmail box. I did see somebody said you could put resend colon and the username or something somewhere in the mail properties and that would fix it, but Google Gmail will filter out any messages that you send to a mailman list, so if you post a Cavi Discuss or whatever from a Gmail address, you will not see your own posts unless you go and look in the archive. Some people have also used Gmail servers as an SMTP relay. Watch out for doing this, however, because if you do that, it will rewrite all of your from addresses and make your messages look as though they came from your Gmail account, not from the email address that you're trying to masquerade through their server. You right? Who? Aiden. Oh, okay. For ITE.
Yeah.
All right. Grace is back. Is my audio back, by the way?
Yeah, you're fine.
That's right. I just went quiet for a bit. Sometimes that happens. Try not to make it too often, though. All right. So DNS runs on port 53, TCP port 53, and UDP port 53. Generally speaking, your machine is configured to talk to an authoritative name server, such as your ISPs or some other DNS server you've configured. So when you look up www.qcat.org, the authoritative DNS server asks the root name server who has information for .org. Then the next thing happens is it asks who has authoritative information for qcat.org, which can be a different set of servers, and then it asks who is www.qcat.org. So it's actually a three-step process of asking the root name servers for .org, then for qcat.org, and then for www.qcat.org. Now, because this can be somewhat time-consuming, especially if you are querying directly from the root name servers, which is not recommended, you can actually you can actually You could actually have, you have a cache which actually remembers what came back from the DNS server, and it hangs on to the results for a certain period of time so that you can look at what got cached. Apparently ipconfig space slash show DNS will show you what is in the DNS cache under Windows XP slash 2000 slash 7. And apparently ipconfig space slash flush DNS will flush your DNS cache. We've just got a note on chat to say that you can actually set up personalities on Gmail so that it doesn't rewrite your addresses. Look, I'm a bit suspicious of Google. There's no such thing as a free lunch, and I have no idea what Google is doing with my personal data. And I find that a bit distressing, given that they are certainly looking at doing a hell of a lot of data mining and stuff, which I'm not sure of the reasoning behind. So it will remain to be seen whether Google is seen to be trustworthy or not. But hey, it's free, so you'll probably have most people using it because it's free, regardless of whether it is trustworthy or not. So they talk about DNS, they talk about FTP, which I think most people will have used by now once or twice. If you haven't, when the Eagle server comes up, you'll certainly get to try that. You're also dealing with, there are other, now they also reiterate the definitions of client and server. So a client is a machine that is looking for services, and a server is a machine who is providing those services. Now, if you have a peer-to-peer network, machines act as both clients and servers. In fact, they decide transaction by transaction as to whether they are a client or a server. The notes also talk about peer-to-peer technology, such as Nutella. I've heard of a lot of people, now, I mean, these networks are somewhat dangerous, and if you download things off peer-to-peer networks, you do run the risk of getting viruses and Trojans and all sorts of other fun stuff. Has anybody, I think I've heard good results about the accessibility of BearShare. A lot of people tend to use BearShare if they do that sort of thing, because apparently it's fairly accessible.
I used to use it. It was fairly accessible, and the only downside is you had to root JAWS to PC to take a look at it. So you could use it, but you had to know what you were doing with JAWS.
Well, I think it's pretty much expected that if you're doing this course, you know what you're doing with JAWS, and I hope we made that clear in the interview phase, that if you've never seen the JAWS cursor before, and know the JAWS cursor is not somebody swearing at their computer, then perhaps you would struggle with some of the more advanced portions of this course. So if you haven't used the JAWS cursor...
get friendly with it.
Yeah, get to know the JAWS cursor, figure out what it does. If you happen to be using Window Eyes, then you can use the mouse pointer cursor thing. And if you happen to be using NVDA, you can use its review mode. If you want flat review, which is the one where it doesn't actually use objects, it just looks at what's on the screen, like JAWS would, you need one of the developer snapshots of NVDA. And if it breaks, you keep both pieces. Anybody here played with NVDA? It's getting quite good.
Apparently the newest snapshot is amazing.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if there was stuff in the new snapshots worth getting.
Microsoft Word support has apparently been vastly improved. Microsoft Word support has been improved, bigger, snappier speed improvements, and I think they've also got flat review, which is means you don't have to deal with that object model that they had previously.
I really like the mouse pointer thing that they use.
Yeah, but have you got enough vision to make that useful, or are you just mad with a mouse?
No, I'm, well, barely enough. Just barely enough. To the point where I can't see the cursor, but I can usually see where it needs to go.
Fair enough. Okay. Because with the old NVDA, they used to have those mouse beeps on by default, and I'm glad somebody went and changed that, because that was really annoying to have it go
every time you... Yeah, by default would be bad.
Yeah, they did have that in one of the 0.6P2, I think it was on by default. For anybody who doesn't know... NVDA is the free screen reader from www.nvda-project.org, I think? Or is it without the dash?
Yeah, I think so. No, it's got the dash.
Yeah, I was pretty sure. www.nvda-project.
Stands for non-visual desktop access, so if you want to look for it, like, it's probably easier to find it by typing in the whole thing. But you should find it either way.
It's very good.
And you can go and read the blog post on why you can't legally get eloquence with NVDA. There's all sorts of wrinkles. Apparently you've got to buy eloquence licenses in lots of 300, and NVDA doesn't have the money to do that.
That is dumb.
Well, poor old Torsten before
that
stinks.
I like eloquence.
He's no longer with us, but Torsten said that if they could find another voice that was as responsive as eloquence on mobile phones, they would get rid of eloquence because of all the bugs. There are about 400 words that will crash eloquence. There's just more than Kasia and the other one that everybody knew about a few years ago.
What's the last time ETI has ever done anything with eloquence?
About 3 or 4 years ago?
Yeah. It's okay. I've actually managed to, and I'm not a big fan of RealSpeak, but I've actually managed to tweak it to the point where it's almost acceptable. It does do decently well when it's sped up.
Yeah, RealSpeak isn't too bad. eSpeak, once you get used to the harshness, and there are about...
That's what I meant.
eSpeak, yeah. You can actually, there are lots more voices on NVDA, and you can actually change it to ones that aren't as harsh as the default voice, because I initially found the default voice was a bit too heavy in the top. But it is fast.
Yeah, I changed it to the American one and raised the pitch a little bit and sped it all the way up, and it sounds much nicer that way. I almost don't notice how painful it is.
Does he speak the default voice for NVDA?
Yes, because it's free.
Open source synthesizer.
Yes. Eloquence is commercial, and as I said, they have to buy a minimum of 300 licenses at $10 a license, so they need like $3,000 to do that, and they'd need to make sure they could get rid of all 300 licenses. As far as finding out more about speech engines, do a search on Sappy 5 voices. There's a whole stack of them. There's the RealSpeak voices, there's the AT&T voices, there's... what else is there? Oh, there's stacks of them.
Kepstrel? I need to see if it's still there.
You know, I'll tell you, if you have Kurzweil, and a legal copy of Kurzweil, Kate, if you're an American, really the most responsive... of the human-sounding voices that you're going to get.
I hate it with a passion.
Love Kate.
That's pretty decent.
Is that real speak or NeoSpeak?
NeoSpeak.
NeoSpeak.
You get Kate and Paul.
My favorite are the real speak ones, but I think I heard the Apple one. I think it's Alex or Adam.
You can't really
like that.
Get that
it
as
really
a sappy
good.
Voice.
You can't get that as a sappy voice because it only runs on the Apple. It also depends on what you're doing with it. Once you're running voices at the speeds that we tend to run them up.
Yeah, like audiobook speed, not the like the play-by-play eloquent style, if you know what I mean.
I have the same problem with the speak, though. When I speed it up, it just turns to crud.
Yeah, we tend to run them at about 400, 500 words a minute, and once you're running a speech synthesizer that fast... you tend to get things that are unintelligible. Why are you getting a non-authoritative answer? Okay, the reason you are getting a non-authoritative answer when you look up qcat.org is because OpenDNS has either cached the response, or because you are not asking the zone edit server directly. If you actually ask ns7.zoneedit.com who www.qcat.org is, you will actually get an authoritative answer. Non-authoritative just means that it hasn't come from the origin server. Alrighty, so... that sort of covers that. So yeah, look up SAPI 5 voices, RealSpeak voices. You may find that there are voices that are text aloud, actually sell a whole stack of them pretty cheap. But I found the Kepstral ones to be really unstable. Alex for the Mac is only for the Mac though. So all of those ones are just Apple only, sadly.
It sounds like the best one. It's got like breathing and other stuff in it. It sounds awesome, but I don't think anything on Windows is as good as that.
Depends on what sort of computer user you are. I find the breathing disruptive and slows it down. As I used to tell people, when I had a partially sighted wife, if I wanted somebody who breathed to read to me, I'd ask my wife to read it to me.
I remember when I first got Windows 7 and 60, and I got 64-bit and it was all new and stuff, there were problems with it. The speech, and this is, I don't believe this would be a problem with the screen readers, but, and I know it's not a problem with JAWS anymore, but 64-bit Windows wouldn't, the speech control panel wouldn't see 32-bit SAPI voices, which means that for programs that don't let you choose a voice, you couldn't select a 32-bit voice as a default, but I believe there are ways around that, or an update or something has fixed that since the last time I tried to do it, which was a while ago. So, just look out for that. Might be an issue, might not. Keep meaning to try.
Yeah, because there aren't that many 64-bit SAPI voices.
No, there are not. RealSpeak is, I think, but only the
John Solo direct
ones. I
want to say that one's been fixed because...
Sorry.
I want to say that's been fixed because I think I got Julie and Kate and all of those showing up in Windows 7 64-bit. So I think that's been fixed now.
Okay.
It would seem as though that would be something they'd pretty keen to fix.
Yeah. I'll have to try again.
Alrighty. Apart from that, they talk about Nutella. They give demonstrations of downloading mysong.mp3. They also talk about HTTP and HTTPS, which I think I'll leave you guys to read in the notes. HTTPS being the secure version of HTTP, which runs on port 443. HTTP generally running on port 80. Anybody have any further questions about Chapter 3's module content? The labs will be edited in the next couple of days. I haven't been doing a huge amount because I've got the lurgy of, had the lurgy of death, so I was asleep for most of it. Alright, if anybody has any questions, email caviinstructors@gots.net. Good luck for the labs in Chapter 1. We'll be looking at Wireshark later today.